Hi, this is Martin again. Installment 2 of my audio cast, radio cast thingamajig here. Unedited audio. I'm going to talk and read to you. You can take me with you to bed. You can take me to your study. You can put me in your car while driving. But I'm not going to edit this because I just don't feel like it. Life's too short for overproduction. Some of you may be aware, hopefully a lot of you are aware, that I wrote a book recently called Pretty Broken Punks, Lipstick, Leather Jeans, A Death of New York. It's available on my website, and it's widely available in the UK right now. We're just about to roll it out in the US with a different version, with photographs and things, and a new cover, which I'll feature in this blog post. And I'm proud to say we're also in development of the stage adaptation, and I've got some pretty cool people helping me with that. So thank you, cool people. Stay tuned. But people have been bugging me to read aloud. I read out the other night at a theater development workshop, and a woman came running up to me and telling me that I had the gig, I had the sound, and then it was my duty to read more. So okay, I will. And some of my lazy-ass friends who can't put two and two together have been begging me to do an audiobook because they're too lazy to read, and I don't quite get it because the book's actually very approachable. I took inspiration from Joey Ramone, who told me that, you know, to write short songs and get the hell off the stage, and, you know, I kind of did. I mean, the longest chapter in here is maybe 10 pages, and I did big type. I didn't do that teeny tiny type. So anyway, enough geeking out, but I'm going to read, and I'm going to give you the introduction today, and maybe some more as we go along. So here we go. Pretty Broken Punks, Lipstick, Leather Jeans, A Death of New York. Copyright Martin Belk. Don't get me wrong. At its grand finale, our club was just as big a spectacle as the day it opened. On the moist Friday night of April 15th, 1994, the same day taxes are due, my friend Blair and I threw our leather MC jackets on stage beneath Mistress Formica's six-inch heels as she belted a rousing You Gotta Fight for Your Right to Be Queer and christened the joint. Just 4 months after Rudolph Giuliani raised his iron fist to be sworn in as mayor of New York City, Squeezebox raised itself on Spring Street and would outlast Rudy's reign over Manhattan. Every Friday night for a decade, the crowds came and came and kept coming. They converged for a rock scene that I took for granted as the only place in the world to be. Black outfits at midnight, guitars screeching till dawn, glitter in your breakfast cereal, torrid affairs before, during, and after. Those of us who worked there lived it, created it, and made love to it. Counterculture became our career. This was good for me most of the time. I was used to the back of the bus. As a young 20-something, if I'd not been running on the go-out, booze, get laid, recover hamster wheel, I could have made something out of Squeezebox, turned it into a true empire, perhaps, like Ian Schrager did with his loot from Studio 54. There was even talk of Squeezebox Records at one point. We certainly had enough bands to sign. There were side gigs at colleges in New Jersey and Vermont and private parties from L.A. to Tokyo. Since the Big Debbie Harry internet show in 1996, she and Chris got back on stage and reunited Blondie, and their new single Maria took over the airwaves internationally. John Cameron Mitchell blew the roof off with Hedwig. Patrick had Psychotica so sewn up, Marilyn Manson was copying a lot of what he created. It was all a sparkling, delicious mess, and I was a mess. But maybe that's exactly how the 20th century was supposed to end. By mid-1997, Clinton's DNA was hardening on Monica's blue dress, and the Republicans would try for years to beat him from office. On the streets, America followed this vibe. We either blew or beat each other. Over time, the cocaine, drug vibe, infighting, and troubles with other underground clubs began to wear me out. People seemed to be shifting from going out to be fabulous, like we did in the Big Apple, to going out to get fucked up, like they did in suburbia. As homogenization trickled down, a lot of folks forgot they were living in the center of the cultural universe at the time. Most of the so-called gay community loathed Squeezebox from the start, most likely because we were only queers. Just queers. None of us went to a gym, owned Lycra, or had any inclination to assimilate. Local magazines wouldn't run our ads. Other so-called alternative clubs made it nearly impossible for us to promote. Nobody played fair, not since the old East Village Pyramid, Black Lips, D-Light, Black Bops, Channel 69, Linda Simpson, Boy Bar, Lady Bunny, Wigstock at Tompkins Square Park days. Not since the fame bugs began to bite, oh no. Contributing to the atmosphere of beige, Giuliani's quality of life troops were hemorrhaging throughout the city. They'd harassed Coney Island High almost out of business. Some chick from Boston actually stood up at a community board meeting and whined because she couldn't sleep in her newly renovated apartment located just above the Coney Island High dance floor, which had been there for only 20 years. A bunch of yuppies and blue hairs formed a group called Save Avenue A Association, although Avenue A didn't need saving unless you were a real estate developer. A really fun night during the week popped up at a place called Cake on Avenue B, and of course, the quality of lifers set their sights square on it. No dancing signs popped up all over the city. Giuliani's cronies found a 79-year-old cabaret law concocted to discriminate against Harlem jazz clubs in the 20s and were now using it to discriminate against Manhattan queers, trannies, hip-hoppers, and ethnic parties in the five boroughs. The city fire marshals were taken from protecting people against fires to put to harassing clubs with phony inspections at 2 a.m. Giuliani took the fireworks away from the Chinese New Year and sanitized Times Square so it would be just like home for all the squeaky tourists who apparently ached for more Disney in their lives. To me, it looked like every city agency was to be stacked with henchmen, and Giuliani's culture war wouldn't stop with nightlife or entertainment. He was forcing community libraries to close, museum to cut back hours. All over town, historic landmarks like the Palladium Theater were falling to the wrecking ball. NYU was allowed to run rampant through the East Village, buying up every piece of property it could get its dirty purple hands on. Thousands upon thousands of arrogant, binge-drinking, yuppie adolescents were herded over the rivers and into our woods to enroll for $30,000 a year at NYU, a university originally founded to educate poor kids. Mr. and Mrs. Fort Wayne and Mr. and Mrs. Nashville took out second mortgages and sent Junior to New York City so he could pretend to be trendy and complain about things. Winks, nods, and blind oversight camouflaged the biggest case of housing fraud in city history. Rent regulations and housing department codes were ignored, inspectors paid off. Had to have been. How else could these landlords turn $700 a month tenement shitholes into $3,000 a month sunny renovated apartments, but with a cheap coat of paint and forged paperwork? My hunch was that Giuliani did it for spite first, profit second. To me, he acted like a spoiled, overgrown teenager who probably never got picked for the baseball team, probably grew up with mommy as his only friend, and probably never got laid until he was a sophomore in college, and even then probably had to pay for it. Now, the rest of us were paying for the mercy fuck he never got. Funny thing was, if he'd have calmed down for even a minute or 10, he might have discovered a real friendship in the very misfits he sought to destroy. For similar reasons, I resented other club and their rainbow promoters who used the same kind of spin to crown themselves kings and queens of nightlife. The big grab was on. Too many folks like Howie Montag, a friend who knew the real score, were gone. Because of AIDS, the credit for almost everything noteworthy on the downtown scene since Studio 54 was up for grabs. And the bottom feeders began grabbing, just like Rudy, who'd grabbed the credit for the drop-in crime. "He cleaned up New York," said the news media and salesman from Kansas City. Bullshit. Crime dropped everywhere because Bill Clinton introduced a balanced budget and people had jobs to go to. My take on all this? Giuliani cleaned up for his pals, petty club promoters pocketed the proceeds of mediocre nightlife, and the whole fucking thing gave me a migraine. So what's a boy to do? Go out, booze, get laid, recover. Repeat. Until he somehow fights a hole in the side of his paper bag. And aside from any criticism that the politically correct naysayers can hurl, at least me and mine were at the pinnacle of our game. Collectively, we were prettier, smarter, grotesque, hornier, and more glamorous than any other group in the whole tired, rotten city. We didn't need to lip-sync. We could sing. We didn't need to search for the stars. They came to Squeezebox all on their own, and through the same damn door as everybody else. Simply by existing. Boys in bikinis dancing next to the Steven Spielbergs of the world. Trannies with new boob jobs dancing with the naked Drew Barrymores of the world. Homeless kids chatting over martinis with the Sandra Bernhards of the world. East Village drag queens like Mistress Formica, Lily of the Valley, Sherry Vine, and Lady Bunny were singing duets with the Deborah Harrys and Mark Almonds of the world. Michael Schmidt was creating fashion with the JFK Juniors of the world. And for a brief moment on this tiny scale of life, we were the world. And many would go on to put a chink in the bourgeoisie armor well into the 21st century. Me, I'd managed to climb from the foothills of North Carolina upstage to the hottest New York City scene since Maxis, Kansas City. In my teenagehood, Debbie, Harry, and folks like Freddie Mercury came through my hi-fi stereo console loud and clear with stuff like "Dreamin' is Free" and "Don't Stop Me Now." And I believed every word, and I still do. But I've also learned beliefs come with a price. But for now, in the words of Sylvester, let's party a little bit. So there you have it, an intro. It holds up pretty well, I think. And I can't wait to get more of this audio stuff done. You'll have to stay tuned for that. And speaking of Hedwig, actually, I've got to give a shout-out this day or week or whatever I'm going to do this to my friends up at Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I mean, good Lord. I just read today they are taking in $1 million a week up there, or they have been anyway. And, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, dreaming is free and belief in yourself and all that matters. And, you know, honest to God, they started that thing in our little rinky-dink club with a $10 cover charge. And now people are paying $300 a seat to see that play. Musical. And, you know, it's on, folks. You've got to bring it forward. You know, this, all these cliches are starting to mean something, and life is too short, you know? So let's write it, let's paint it, let's think it, let's create it, you know, because it ain't going to come from no television, which is why I'm exactly doing this. And it sure as hell ain't coming from Facebook or the rest of this stuff. So join me next time. I'll see you later.